Those that are on the email list, I sent you a copy of the couple of verses that I want to look at for this evening. And I know that everyone is perfectly aware of where we're at on the calendar. And we only have from now till Sunday, Sunday evening, to prepare for Shavuot. Now, the interesting thing about Shavuot is just like counting the Omer in many respects. And in counting the Omer, I think some of you came to an awareness that there's a whole lot more to this than what I thought. And then you realize that there's a lot of work to do on yourself spiritually before you get to Shavuot. And that being said, it is somewhat surprising to know the things that are semi-expected of you. Now, when I worked on counting the Omer, or the things for counting the Omer, I had one fundamental idea in mind, and that was to think about what we would have to do before we reached the mountain, let's say. And now, this evening, we're just about at the same time on the calendar as a couple of verses that I sent out. So if you did not get the verses, we are at Exodus 19 and 9. We're going to start right there. Now, one of the things that is imperative at this particular time is to understand two particular aspects about Shavuot. Number one, it is, as we all are perfectly aware of, the receiving of the Torah. So you can read, starting in Exodus, you know, 18, and then start into 19, and then by 19 you start to see the mountain, you start to see the things that are going on the mountain, and then as those things continue, then you come to a place where what you will see is the elders of the group of all of the B'nai Yisrael, and they are going to go up to the top of the mountain, and there they're going to commune, they're going to dine with God, as it were. Okay, so this makes basically two imperatives at this particular time of the year. Number one is to prepare for the reception of the Torah, and number two is to have a meal wherein you commune with God. But when you take this meal and understand this meal, it is very important that you understand that it is much, much, much deeper than, oh, let's sit down and have a tuna fish sandwich or whatever it might be that you had on the menu that day. But nevertheless, the point here being is that the meal is imperative. And having a meal and discussing Torah around the table as you have the meal is absolutely imperative. Nothing takes greater precedence than that, especially from the verses that we cited that are in Shemot 24, 9 through 11. And we'll try to get to that if we get time tonight. But the thing that is imperative to understand is that it is imperative that the meal takes precedence over many other things. Now, you can look on some of the websites if you so choose, and you can find a holiday guide. I get a holiday guide from Kabod every time there's a holiday or something comes close. But that's just because I'm on the list and not because I follow their holiday guide. And I'm not telling you, or am I recommending that you go to Kabod and find out what they recommend. Reason being, not because I think that they're bad people or anything of that nature, but because they're Ashkenaz, okay? And they do things differently than the Sephardi do, okay? So, for example, it's primarily a dairy meal for the Ashkenaz, but not necessarily so for the Sephardi, okay? The Sephardi sometimes will have some of the staples, you know, lamb, etc., those types of things. So they do sometimes break away from that and have meat and not dairy. But the customary thing is, based on the idea that this is the milk of God's word, is to have, you know, a dairy meal or something of that nature. But again, it's not imperative that you do that, okay? So well, let's look at this verse, first verse that we're going to look at in Exodus 19, 9 through 10. And I'm reading from the translation that comes with Mikraot Gedolot, and I don't know what translation that is. That is the... it's the Tanakh, it's the 1917 Masoretic text, okay? So that's where I'll be reading from. Verse 9, "And the Lord said to Moshe, I will come to you in a thick cloud in order that the people may hear when I speak with you, so that so trust you after ever after. And Moshe reported to the people the words of the Lord. And the Lord said unto Moshe, go to the people and warn them, number one, to stay pure today and tomorrow. And number two, let them wash their clothes." Okay. So now let me just give you a couple of hints about something that is not, I've not heard a lot about it in our particular class, but or in our group. But that's because we've seldom really focused on things that we could call Kabbalistic or Seorik or, you know, mystical or anything of that nature. And most of you know that in this class, we try to take things a little bit deeper than just the superficial things. But in my Sunday morning class, they're getting a chance to get their hair wet, I mean the top of their hair, and go underwater and drink there as well. So they're getting introduced to all the spirituality very much as well. And many times the two classes kind of have a little bit of a overflow into one another. But let's read the last line again, or last verse, and said, Lord said to Moshe, go to the people to warn them to stay pure today and tomorrow. Okay, so here you have a statement that is very, very interesting because it says to stay pure. Now it's telling them, let's put it this way, it's telling them to stay in a state that we call a state of Kedusha, which is basically holiness. But holiness is not really the best word. The best way to really say it is that they have to stay committed to the ideal of God or the ideals of God. Now, when that is said, you have to ask a question. And the question you have to ask is, how do they know how to stay pure? Okay? Because basically what is being intimated here is what? It's literally the Torah, right? Because the Torah gives you the rules for how to stay pure, how to do mikvah, how to do all these things. But they don't have the Torah yet. They're here to receive the Torah, but God is telling Moshe to tell them, stay pure. Okay, stay consecrated to God. And literally here, it's not just consecrated to God, it's consecrated to the purpose of receiving the Torah. So you can see what needs to be the focal point in our mind right now. Stay consecrated for the next few days, today and tomorrow. This is going to be the right before giving of the Torah, of course. So he says, today and tomorrow, make sure you stay pure. Stay consecrated. Consecrated to the task of receiving the Torah, okay? Now, it's a lot deeper than that. But, you know, the problem is that, again, he's saying, look it, stay pure. Where do we get the idea of how to stay pure? We get it from the Torah, right? So if we're getting it from the Torah, it's like they have a precognizant awareness of what the Torah says. Is everybody with me? You understand what I'm saying? So in other words, they already know the Torah in a certain capacity, and they're to follow the Torah in order to receive the Torah. Wait a minute. This is an issue, right? Sounds like a Jewish problem to me, really, you know. So when you get two Jews together, you know, you got, you know, three synagogues, you know, the one that each one of them go to and the one that neither one of them would go to. So this is kind of a situation where you're saying, you're telling me to stay pure. The rules for ritual purity, they're in the Torah. They already know the rules of ritual purity. They have a form of Torah, but they have to have the form of the Torah so they can receive the Torah. Everybody with me? So we call this like a conundrum, right? It's a problem that you're going, I got to scratch my head here for a minute and figure this out. Okay? Now let's go to the latter portion of that verse and the last few words. And it said, and let them wash their clothes. Red flag go off to anybody else besides me? I mean, there's a problem here, right? Because you read, I think it's Deuteronomy somewhere, it says that their clothes never got dirty. Their clothes never got washed. They never had to wash them. They never were filthy. They were immaculate the whole time. They never changed clothes from the first day they stepped out of Egypt until the day that they walk into the promised land. Now, I know the reason for that was there was no Walmart, no Macy's, no whatever, right? Okay, so you understand here that there's a problem with this question. Number one, stay pure. How do you stay pure? You find the rules in the Torah. Number two, make sure your clothes are clean. So you're saying, wait a minute, I know their clothes didn't get dirty, I know they didn't wear out, et cetera, and the red flags are going off all over your head, and you're saying, what is the issue here? Because this is something that has supposed to already been taken care of. But here, they're about to receive the Torah, and as they're about to receive the Torah, the big question is, are you going to stay clean? Well, I don't know how to stay clean unless you tell me how to stay clean. I don't know what the laws of ritual purity are unless you tell me all of that. So what's Moshe going to do for the next 3 days? Tell them how to stay clean and then tell them that their clothes are not going to wear out, but you got to make sure that your clothes are clean? Now, what I want you to understand is this. When you start reading the Torah, generally when you come across these little problems like that, you know, there's a flag raised and somebody saying, hey, there's an issue here. It's very, very difficult to try to discern, you know, what is going on. Now, let's go, if you want to, just for a second, and we'll come back to this in a minute, and I'll try to answer some questions, to Shemot 24, 9 through 11, okay? This is the imperative part where it says that we must have a festival table. We have to have a table service, if you will. Now, what I want you to understand is that table service means that you eat the food, but it does not just mean you eat the food. You do what? You have a conversation, right? And so one of the ideals is that you're supposed to discuss the mitzvot, et cetera, et cetera. Now, some of them, when they say that you're supposed to talk about the commandments and all of the things, some say, well, you just talk about the Ten Commandments. If you talk about the Ten Commandments, you fundamentally have covered the categories of all the other commandments, and so it's not an issue. So, you know, talk about the Ten Commandments. So as long as you're literally, let's put it this way, the technicality is, as long as you're talking about the Torah, you're doing fine, right? Because you don't have to say, well, let's go through the 613 tonight before we have our dinner. And then you start reading number one, number two, and 613. Oh, yeah, and by the way, the rabbis say, and, you know, so this is, in some places, there's, of course, the tradition. And it's a tradition basically across the board, but it is probably more Sephard than it is Ashkenaz to stay up all night and read the Torah. Okay? Now, I'm not going to make everybody do that, but there will be a quiz the next morning. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so here's the thing. It says, verse 9, 24 and 9, said that Moshe, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and the seven elders, 70 elders of Israel ascended, and they saw the God of Israel. Problem. And under his feet there was a likeness of pavement, and like the very sky of purity. Yet he did not raise his hand against the leaders of the Israelites, and they beheld God. They ate and they drank, and the Lord said to Moshe, come up to me on the mountain and wait there, and I will give you the stone tablets of the teachings of the commandments which I have inscribed to instruct them. Okay, now one of the things that I'm going to ask you straight up is just look back into the verse for just a second. Tell me what they had for dinner. What did they eat? Did they have rack of lamb? Did they have Leviathan? Did they? What did they have? What is the dinner that they have? It doesn't tell you anything about the dinner. It said they ate and they drank. It's like eat, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we're going to receive the Torah. Okay? So, or they've already done it, but in the way that the verses are reading, this is reading almost as if they already received it, which we read in chapter 20. But when you get to chapter 20 and then you come back here, you're thinking, well, like he's going to go up and give them the stone tablets with the teachings, etc. Now, I'm not going to get all into the chronology of everything that's going on, but here you have a problem. And the problem is that they're called up. Number one, they see God. Says God does not, will not put his hand on any one of them. And he doesn't destroy them. He doesn't kill them. He doesn't whatever. And they've been there. They see God. And then it says they ate and they drank. So they had a meal. Okay? And number three, the problem is it doesn't tell you what they had to eat. Anybody else notice the problem besides me? Have you ever noticed that in many places, though, in the Bible, or most specifically more in the Torah or in the Tanakh? But, you know, you have God's going to have some sort of a meal, and when he has a meal, he has the meal, but it never tells you what they ate. Didn't say they had, like I said a minute ago, a rack of lamb or whatever it was that they might have wanted to eat. It doesn't say that they had any of that. And so it just says, they ate. Well, that sounds good, you know, but if I'm going to go someplace in East, I want to know what's on the menu. And so here's the B'nai Yisrael. They're going there, and they're saying basically, you know, okay, God, what's on the menu? And then he goes up there and said, well, I made a couple of bologna sandwiches. Anybody want one? And here you go. And, you know, well, we ran out, so I counted to 69, but I forgot there was going to be, etc. So here's the situation. Let's go back to chapter 19. Let's work this detail out. If we have time, we'll work with the food issue. If not, we'll cover that rest of it next week. And I will give you, before we conclude, I will give you the hint about the food and how to look at that particular set of passages, but then there's all the fun of tearing it apart. Okay, so back to, you know, the last verse 10, and he said, go to the people, tell them stay pure. So in this process, one of the things you have to realize is that they have been associated with Torah before they get to the mountain. Okay, now last week I talked about this. I talked about this in the sense that I said, what happens on the mountain is God comes down and he kisses the mountain. And as he kisses the mountain turns into flames and et cetera, et cetera. But now, you know, let me just backtrack on that just for a minute. Okay, so it comes down and he kisses the mountain. And if you can imagine God's lips kissing the mountain, then, you know, whatever you can imagine. Because my mind is going like, wow, that is a real complicated thing to try to do. But nevertheless, he comes down. And then it said, as he's kissing the mountain, I'm paraphrasing the idea here. As he kisses the mountain, what happens? The mountain starts smoking. And then I tell you, last week I said, well, that's because the Shekinah is coming down and kissing God. But the Shekinah can be either masculine or feminine, okay? So if we say that the earth took the form of the masculine, then Shekinah comes down and it heats up the mountain, and the mountain smoking, and they're hearing voices and everything. And I'm going to tell you very bluntly, Elizabeth, close your ears. I'm just kidding. Okay. And you know what it reminds me of? Look at, you know, it says there's fire. Okay. How many of you know that every time it says fire in the Word of God, it does not mean there is a fire? Okay. It's a metaphor. Everybody understand what a metaphor is? It's there for you to not see the first thing that you looked at or thought of, but see something different. That's a metaphor. Okay. So here's the point. You know, God comes down and he kisses the mountain. And so if you understand this idea to be Shir HaShirim, or the Song of Solomon, where it's talking about two lovers, and the two lovers come together and they kiss. Well, when two lovers come together and they kiss, there's always a fire. It's the passion that burns inside of them. Your heart is on fire. Well, your heart's not really on fire, but, you know, you're moved with, you know, a spiritual sense of whatever when you get kissed by your lover, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is partially some of the imagery that we see when it comes down to this. Now, when we come to the eating part, this really comes into play, okay? But let's finish up on 9 through 10 first, okay? So we know from Scripture that, I'm just going to use one person, Abraham. It said Abraham knew the commandments. He followed the commandments of God. Everybody knows that, right? Everybody understands, all of us that have been here for more than a day know that it basically says that Abraham kept all the commandments. But wait a minute. Did he already have a Torah? No, he didn't have a Torah. Okay? But he had a Torah. Okay? And we talked about this last week. Okay? He had a Torah, but what was the Torah that he had? The Torah that he had was called the Torah Kaduma. And the Torah Kaduma is what it is the primordial Torah. Okay, but it is not in written form. It is only in spiritual form. Okay, now the interesting thing about it in that state, it is near infinite. Okay, if you go a little bit higher in the spiritual realm, you get to the person that is called the Adam Kadmon. He's the prototype of humanity. He's the prototype of Messiah, and he's the blueprint for all of creation. This one man. Okay. It's literally a spiritual realm as well, okay? So if you can imagine, you know, you've gone through five realms, you're at this level called Adam Kadmon. It's the highest level that is possible without reaching the eternal God and what is called the concealed face of God, okay? Which means that you can't see that part. But you come to this place, and a place is called Ein Sof, which just means the endless. Okay, so you get to this point of endlessness, and at that point, or in that liminal threshold, there's a threshold there, then what you have there is the birth of something called the Torah Kaduma. Okay, and it exists, the only problem is it exists in a near infinite state, but it is not quite infinite in the sense that God is the only thing that is truly, truly endless, okay? We will be endless, we are endless, but we emanated from God. So that means we're a piece of God, we flowed out of God as, you know, the soul that we are. And as we flowed out at being the soul that we are, then we can't ever die. Okay? Or the neshama part can never die because it's connected to God. I mean, it's literally infused in God. Okay? So, they must have had a Torah to understand the laws of purity. And it says, and the commentaries tell us that Abraham kept the Torah. So we understand that there's this spiritual Torah that's in the atmosphere, in the spiritual world, however you want to describe it. And this spiritual Torah that's in the atmosphere is the Torah that told them how to keep and be spiritually pure. Okay? So then he comes to our clothes washing time. Now, what in the world is it trying to say here? Because we know that it says that their clothes, Deuteronomy, whatever it is, let's see if I can find the verse here. I'll tell you later. It's here somewhere. I think it's in Deuteronomy 8 or something like that. But nevertheless, it tells us straight up, the clothes didn't wear out. So then he's telling them, you wash these clothes. Well, there's other ideas of how the clothes were made, what they were made of, the materials, and none of the material that it talks about is any type of terrestrial material at all. It didn't say they got some of it from a goat, some of it from a whatever. There's no thing that constructs the clothes that they wear that it is finite or material. So the clothing that they wear, it must be undoubtedly some sort of a spiritual garment that they're wearing. But of course, you know there's a problem, right? Thank you, Garrett Krista, 8:4. Deuteronomy 8:4. Okay, so you understand that here's this thing, you know, wash your clothes. Well, number one, all of us know straight up, wash your, well, if it said wash your body, which it does have some insinuation here, right? Because stay pure, okay? And what happens if you're not pure? How do you solve the problem? You go to the mikvah, right? Okay, so you go dunk, you dunk three times, you come out, and you're clean as a whistle. But what has happened in this process is that there is what we call the dissolution of form. And a dissolution of form is like, you know, when you go to the coffee station and you put a little chocolate in. This is my recipe, okay? You put a little chocolate in. You put a little honey in. You put a little mocha creamer in there. Just a little bit of the regular creamer. And then I got a lot of hot coffee. Okay? And then it's what I call ambrosia. I wake up. I know that God's having one with me every morning. He tells me so. I'm just kidding. Okay? But now you understand that when you pour the water in, or the coffee in, first you put water into the coffee, then the water absorbs the coffee, and then the coffee poured into the other ingredients absorb all of the elements that are in the cup, and there's a dissolution. It all becomes one thing. Now, spiritually speaking, when you go through the mikvah, it's as if, and I talked about this the other morning, I think, in my class in Sunday. What happens, he goes, zip, all of you, you're completely dissolved in the mikvah, to where there's nothing left of you. Then you come up out of the water the first time, pieces of you reassemble. Then you go back down, up, until you've done it three times. And then when you come out, then you get completely reassembled. And I said that this is where Gene Roddenberry from Star Trek gets the idea of beaming people from one place to another. Disassemble them, put them back over here in another place, and yeah, it's all done. This is the mikvah. The mikvah takes you apart piece by piece, then puts you always back together, but always on a more elevated status. Okay? You don't go into the mikveh and come back out the same old person that you were. You may not have a mentality change yet, but you've been elevated spiritually when you go through the mikveh. Okay? So the interesting thing here is that if you're going to tell me that, number one, staying pure means that if you do something wrong, that you're going to have to go through the mikveh. And number two, if you're going to tell me if you take your clothes off, then the insinuation of taking your clothes off is the mikveh. So all of the insinuations that you have in this verse is that God is telling these people to go through the mikveh. Now, they just came from the Sea of Reeds or the Yam Suf, right? They go through a valley of water, and there's no water. Well, there's water on one side, water on the other side, water above them, and of course we all know they're floating through on the clouds of glory, etc. And so they're completely surrounded by water. And the story or the idea comes down to Chacham Shaul, Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and he said they were all immersed into Moshe's immersion. But it didn't say that they just went through an immersion. He said they went through Moshe's immersion. Okay? So what was Moshe's immersion? It had to be something weird because there was no water. They didn't go through water. They walked on dry ground, and etc., and they come up on the other side, they've immersed, they are elated spiritually, elevated spiritually, but there's not one drop of water that they dipped in. Are you with me? Now, when you read Paul, he keeps talking about this type of mikveh over and over and over. And he said, you were dead, you were buried with Messiah, and you were resurrected. But the picture that we know from Judaism is that he could be talking about a mikveh, right? Because when you go down, you die, and then you come up, you're what? You're born again. That statement came from Judaism, not Christianity, okay? And so, interestingly enough, you're born again. But Paul is not talking about that. And one of my mentors said, you know, you ever notice how Paul has all of these waterless immersions? And you're scratching your head and you're going, yeah, you know what? There are a bunch of them, right? Okay, so if you're going to tell me that they're in the middle of the desert, 600,000 of them, and by now, a few days later, surely there'd probably a couple of kids were born in the process, right? Maybe not, I don't know. But nevertheless, you know, 600,002, okay? And so they've had a couple of kids, or there's whatever there is, and you're going to tell me 600,000 people are going to go to the mikveh. I see a problem. Anybody else see a problem? Where are you going to get the water? I know you're going to say something about the rock. Well, who knows? But the whole idea here is it's about all this ritual purity, this mikveh-oriented ideal, and there's not a drop of water to be found. Okay? So this is 100% a spiritual thing. So what are they going to immerse in? What is the immersion that they will be taking in? Okay, so if you're going to tell me that they've immersed in something that they've already received, they're immersing themselves in the Torah. Okay? What is the mechanism for purity anyway? It's the Torah. So when you see this idea, they're being immersed in this Torah Kadmon, the primordial Torah. Now that creates another problem. Anybody else see the problem? Nobody else sees the problem? I see a problem. Look, you're going to tell me you go immerse in the Torah that I gave you, or I gave your forefathers, and then you just wait right here because I'm going to give you another Torah? You got one. Now I'm going to give you two. Does anybody know that there might have been three? Everybody's scratching their head now, right? Oh, it's simple. It's as easy as arithmetic, right? Especially that, what do they call that, that real trigonometry and stuff like that. You know, it's easy as that stuff. That's cut and dried. I could do that in my sleep. I can't do it any other time, but just in my sleep. Okay, so understand this. Number one, let's ask the question. Why would you want to immerse in the primordial Torah before you receive the Torah of Sinai? Because we know what's going to happen with the Torah of Sinai is what? It's going to be written down, okay? And therefore, once it's written down, it's fixed. So when you read the Torah, and it says, thou shalt not. And that's holy language from the King James himself. Okay, when you read those verses, don't do this, don't do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. It's fixed. You have it written in stone, literally, in the cubes that Moshe is about to get when he goes up the top of the mountain. So what is the deal here? Now I'm going to tell you what I think. It's not, maybe not worth anything, but I'm going to tell you what I really see here. Number one, I believe, just like I said, that here you go to the top of the mountain with the 70 elders, and it says they're up there and they ate and drank. But it doesn't tell you one thing that they ate and drank. It tells you what they saw, but it doesn't tell you what they ate. So then you have to come to the conclusion that the feast was not food you put in your mouth, but something that you see with your eyes. Are you with me? Okay, so the whole feast is, number one, God. It said they saw the God of Israel. Then they saw the pavement that he was standing on. It's a picture in the mirror of what you see in Isaiah chapter 6. And then it says they saw all the sapphire stones and all of the stones and all of the things here. And then it said they saw the sky. But when you look in Hebrew, it's not sky. It's what? Shemayim. We all know this, okay? So Shemayim is what? The heavens. You never say it in the singular. We always say it in the plural because Shemayim means it's plural. Okay, so they're looking at all of these things. This becomes the feast of the eyes. Now, all of us here know that there's a cliche in the Talmud that says, come in here. And when you come in here, you listen, right? And then there's assembly of whatever, and then you learn your lesson from listening to the Torah. But in the spiritual realm, it never says, come in here. It always says, come and see. Okay? Because it's moving beyond something that is finite and limited. You know, even in the realm of the physical, when we look at things, we're going, wow, man, what a beautiful sunset. Or, man, can you imagine a house right there in the middle of that where I could live in wonderful peace and harmony? There's always the imagination. It kicks in. It engages with the eyes. It will do so with the ears, obviously. But nevertheless, you understand. Okay? So number one, back to the verses that we start with. Stay pure and wash your clothes. I think here that the idea is that they're being taught and being told to use the Torah that you received that was handed down by your forefathers. And as they're receiving this Torah that was handed down or given to the forefathers and handed down to them from father to son, from father to son, from father to son, Okay? And then they receive this. But then God says, you use this Torah to stay pure so that I can give you this Torah as well. So now, once we receive the Torah at the mountain, we have two Torahs. What is the purpose of having two Torahs in the system in the way that it was given first to Abraham and then this Torah that we receive on the rock? What is the purpose for this? Well, you know, some guys, now I've never met one of these guys, but they say they're around. They say some of these guys are so heavenly minded they're no earthly good. I've not found any one of them really that meets that criteria, but nevertheless, it is a cliche, right? That is this potential. But here's this, okay? You know, you come along with this guy, he's out, you know, looking for wood, and he says, look at here, man, here's the forest of trees. This will do good for the project that God gave me. And what is the project God gave him? He said, Noah, build a boat. Noah says, God, get somebody else. And he said, Noah, how long can you tread water? Do you think Noah said, well, maybe not that long? Okay, God, I'll make the boat. Okay? Now look at everybody else around him. He goes, Noah, what are you doing? I'm building a boat. God told me to build a boat. Yeah, you're one of those guys, huh? You know, if they could have caught him today, if they caught him, you know what would have happened to him? They'd have given him a coat. Again, dress him in a nice, clean, white coat. Of course, it's got long sleeves that wrap around the back and they lock in the back. You know, everybody understands. You call it a crazy jacket. Okay, so here's a guy saying that it's going to rain. If he had a copy of the written Torah, he could go, look, right here, it says it's going to rain. And everybody would say, nah, you can't trust that book. That book is no good. But when you start to tell them that God told you and there's no book, period, then they really think you're flipped out. Now you take that to some guy like Elijah, who comes along. He sees the sins of the people. He sees the sins of the king and all that. He said, it's not going to rain. And everybody's like, what have you been smoking? We live right there. It's the Mediterranean Sea. What do you mean? And so you begin to see that what happens is these people are taking hold of something. Now, we know Elijah had the written Torah, but nevertheless, you understand they're taking hold of something that's up here in the spiritual world. And they're bringing that data down into this world. And when they bring that data down into this world and they say, thus says the Lord, then they're going to say, you know, before the time of Moshe, yeah, you're crazy too. Well, look at what happened to Abraham. You know, he's saying that God is the Most High God, and it made Nimrod mad. And according to the tradition, what happens? He throws him into the fire. Okay, so now when you get to the day after the giving of the Torah, they've got something hard, something concrete. They can say, here's where it says, this is how you do ritual purity. Okay, so what they can do very easily now is say, goodbye, Torah, to the Kadmon, Torah Kadmona. Now, we don't need it anymore. We got this right here. All we have to do is just read it right there, and that's good enough. Sounds like some religious groups that I've heard of. Now, we don't buy that other stuff. We don't. No. Look, it's right here. But they don't stop and think about, you know, how long was it that all of these years were before Moshe gets the Torah? And it has a record of the very beginning. So, now here's the problem. When you step over the boundary into the time of receiving the Torah of Moshe, it's written down. But we understand very clearly that it being written down does not mean that the Torah Kadmona is of no value. Okay? Because the whole purpose now is to synchronize them together. Okay? But now I'm going to complicate the matters just a little bit more and say there's another Torah. All of you know, right? There is another Torah. What do we call it? The Torah Shebal Peh. The Torah of the mouth. In other words, it is the Torah that has been spoken. We call it the oral Torah. Okay? So what is the oral Torah? The oral Torah is a mixture of the revelation of the Torah Kadmona mixed with the Torah of Sinai, put through the mouths of the sages, and then as they spit it out of their mouth, then eventually one of their students goes, that's pretty good stuff, I'm going to write it down. So he's taking notes in class, and then he goes, look, here's what you said, Rabbi, is that what you said? And the rabbi said, yeah, but let's fix this, let's fix that, let's fix that. And then all of a sudden, now we have three Torahs. But literally, it's still all one Torah, okay? Because it's the merging of all three. They had this thing in the spiritual realm which they could draw down if they had attained the level high enough of consciousness, high enough to receive that Torah, they could bring it down. Now today, as we rehearse what we did and said last week, now today there's a problem. And the problem today is to take the Torah that exists as the Kadmona, and then the Torah that exists as Masinai, or from Mount Sinai, and then the Torah, Shebal Peh, and then marry all three of those together. And then let's take any student who's sitting there, and he's studying Torah. So he's got his Chumash out, and he's reading the Torah, and then he's going, well, you know, in the spirit world, I see this. And so he wants to add that to his lecture or his studies or whatever. And then he wants to go, and he wants to do what? He wants to take and read what Rabbi so-and-so said about it. And so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so. And then as he's reading, Rabbi Ibn Ezra, he says, oh my God, you see what he said? And then he has another piece. Well, where did the piece that he got from Ibn Ezra, where did it come from? Just with the words that were written on the page? No, not at all. Where did it come from? Partially from here, partially from here, and a lot of right here, where you see that Torah Kadmona, okay? Now, the problem is people get into these ironclad fixed rules where you got to have it this way. Now, listen. There are four basic hermeneutic levels. We all know them, okay? But when you get to what is called Sa'od, the most spiritual or whatever, it's like having a Lamborghini, and then you're driving on the Santa Monica Freeway, and it's bumper to bumper. You got a car that will do nearly 200 miles an hour, and you're going bumper to bumper with it, and you got all this pent-up energy in that car waiting to be released. Now, in Europe, they have a thing called the Autobahn. Anybody ever hear about that? you can get on that thing. It used to be, I don't know if it's still the same today, but fast as your car will go, that's the limit. I watched this one car show once. They were in a Porsche 911 or something like that. They're doing 200 and some miles an hour down the Autobahn. The guy that is the hosting the show and interviewing the driver says, where do you put the coffee cup? I'm going, this guy is totally retarded. You're going to drink coffee going down the road at 210 or 11, 14, whatever miles an hour. And interestingly enough, you know what the guy said? Nothing. He's like, if you're that stupid, go ahead and ask that question. So what I'm trying to say is this, to make this equation. The Torah that is in the spiritual world has not been drained yet. It has not been tapped. It has not been depleted. It is still there, and it's near infinite. And, you know, when you start to look at material that has been accumulated by the Jewish people over the years, and we could say this both spiritual data and data that qualified for a Nobel Prize, less than 1% of 1% of the people in the world are the dominant winners of the Nobel Prize, the Jewish people. Isn't that amazing? Why? Because they know there's this Torah Kadmona where you can reach outside of the box. And when you reach into that Torah, and then you say, well, let me check that with this from the Torah Sinai that came from Sinai, and then the Torah that the rabbis speak, you go, wow, nobody ever thought of this before. I must be a genius. So my point here is this. They come here, and God's telling them, you stay pure. How do you stay pure? You use the Torah that is Kadmona, the thing that existed from before creation. How do I know that's the truth? Okay, we have a passage in the oral Torah said that what God did was look into the Torah and create the world. Or create creation. So the Torah, it tells us right then that it's the blueprint. Now, did anybody ever read in, what is it, Proverbs 8 and 22? And it talks about wisdom and said, I was his playmate. We played together in the eternal eons. And then I was his craftsman. He wanted to build. I said, okay, let's build it like this. And we built it. And it's a picture of course, of chokhmah, of wisdom. But not only is it a picture of chokhmah and wisdom, it's a picture of Messiah. Okay? But wait. You know, we want to throw all the work on Messiah. What about you? What about me? Did you ever have an idea? I had this idea that I thought would be really, really cool. It was kind of based on the Jetsons a little bit. And, you know, anybody who drives down the road in Henry County in Tennessee and they get it to go out in the morning, if you go out at the wrong time, you get stuck behind a school bus. So I had a solution. I said, let's just build these tubes underground to go to the school. When it's time for your kid to go to school, what do? Just pop him in the tube and he'll come out right in the classroom. Couldn't get any billionaires to support me on my idea, so it just remains an idea. But here, now the point here is that there is this infinite of Torah. And it has not yet been depleted. But people think that because there is a Torah that is written, that's the end of it, it's limited, and we can't go beyond what the limit is of that particular idea or those writings. You know why some people argue against it? Because they never wrote a word to support it or negate it. In other words, they weren't a rabbi, so they couldn't write it. They couldn't say it. They didn't have an opinion. But the stupidity is everybody's got an opinion. And you can say it positive, negative, or whatever, but each one of us has an idea. Oh, you know what I see when I see that? So you say, just because that's not written here, or, you know, I haven't received that revelation yet, that it's no good? I'll confess. So me and the AI this afternoon, we had an argument. You know, so I asked the AI, I said, on these verses right here, said, is there a portion of the Zohar that deals specifically with these verses? So the thing spits out something that looks like the New York Times. And it's got all this data in it. And it's going to take me 3 hours to read through the data to try to figure out whether or not it was there. And, I text the thing back and said, are you stupid? Now, of course, you're going to ask an AI if it's stupid, right? And, somebody else is shaking their head. No, I don't tell it, are you stupid? I said, what's wrong with you, stupid? Okay, because I said, I ask you a very simple question. I want to know, is there a Zohar portion for this particular verse? And it comes back and said, no, there's no portion. I said, why didn't you give me the New York Times to begin with to try to go through all this data to figure it out? Okay, so the long comes the short, I went to the Zohar myself. You know, I know how to read the Zohar. I know how it's paginated. I know how to hunt it down. But when push comes to shove, no, there was nothing there. But you think I'm going to believe that AI? Okay. So, God is telling the people here something very, very fantastic. I'm going to give you something in writing that you can rely on as the absolute truth. But I don't want you to get rid of the revelation knowledge that you've had before, because now I'm going to mix the two of them together, and now when you receive a revelation knowledge, you can look at it in the Torah and say, that's what God was saying. It doesn't have to be, you know, oh, you had two-day-old pizza yesterday, and your stomach's all wound up, and you're feeling a little ill, and so this hallucination hit you, or what? Now, some people say that there's a drug that you can take that allows you to talk to God. And so, I don't know if it's true or not, but, you know, when somebody tells me there's a drug available to do something like that, I've got an encyclopedia at work. This guy's been a drug addict for years. So, you know, he's been through everything that you can imagine. So I just go to the guy and say, hey, Brian, you know, what about DMT? They say if you do DMT, you can talk to God. And I said, did you ever do DMT? And he said, yeah. I said, well, did you talk to God? He goes, no. He said, I was just talking to myself. He said, and if you do it twice, you know what happens? You get yourself, talking to you. It doesn't get better. So here's the deal. You can look into the Torah and it says, you know, a donkey talked. Any other time, if you said a donkey talked, And you told people that, they go, yeah, I know where you're from. I'm going to tell you this story in close. This guy, he had a dog. He had a sign in the front yard. Said, talking dog, $10 for sale. This guy's driving down the road and he sees this sign where it says, $10 for a talking dog? This is crazy. So he stops in the shanty. It's like a shanty shack. The house is just about to fall in and all that stuff. And so the guy pulls up there and he goes up, knocks on the door. Some old bearded guy, he looks like from Duck Dynasty or whatever, comes out. And he says, what can I help you with? And he said, sign says you got a talking dog and you're going to sell it for $10. He said, yeah. He goes, do you really have a talking dog? He goes, yeah, he's out back. He said, you want to talk to him? He said, yeah, well, yeah. He goes back there and he's talking to the dog. As he's talking to the dog, he said, well, something, you know, how old were you when you learned you could talk? The dog said, oh, man, I was just a pup. And he said, well, what happened in your life? He said, well, he said, because I could talk and I could be in these places, nobody believed a dog could talk. He said, I started working for the CIA. He said, so the CIA would fly me all over the world. They'd put me in a room with all these people, and they'd be talking about all their spy business. I'd be listening, you know, as soon as we got out of the meeting, and I'd tell them everything they said. And so he said, wow, that is amazing. He said, yeah, but, you know, I got wife and kids, man. And, you know, you're gone all the time. You know, they start crying because you're gone all the time. He said, so I took a local job. I was working for the airport. And he said, you know how you see some of them dogs going along, they're looking and sniffing in packages. He said, I just sat on the side of the thing, and he said, I could listen to them talking about, you know, I hope that nobody finds out I got drugs in that package. Then he'd go over, sniff the package, and wag his tail, and then, you know, they'd bust the guy. He was more accurate than all the other dogs. So this guy is just absolutely flabbergasted that this dog, you know, has got these experiences and he can talk. My God. So he goes around to the guy and he says, you only want $10 for that dog out there? He goes, yeah. He goes, well, why? He said, did he tell you all that stuff about his jobs and all that stuff? And he said, yeah. He said, that's a blasted lie, man. He never did none of that stuff. So, now when they accuse you of finding some secret in the Torah, you have some place that you can say, look, it's right here. But you marry those two worlds together, and that's exactly what God was looking for. You marry that world with this world. I told you how to be pure. You be pure, and when you're pure, then you will receive this. But the purity he's talking about is what we've been working on for now. It'll be 47 days tonight, and when you see this nullification of yourself, you have to understand that it doesn't mean God wants to get rid of you. It means that God wants to use you. He wants you to be the talking dog. No, the vessel that he speaks through, so that the people will say, you mean there's going to be a flood? There's going to be a flood. Okay, but understand that there has to be a marrying of those two worlds. We don't rely fully on one, and we don't rely fully on the other, but they have to be married together. And I think that is the message that God is trying to speak to us even this very night and say, stay pure, it's here. But look for a refreshing of receiving the Torah in these next few days. And I pray that everyone will have a wonderful, wonderful Shavuot. Now, it's your time to shine. Questions and comments. Don't tell me any talking dog stories. I've already heard those.
Your Eminence, I'm just going to be the dumb one tonight and ask the question, what was this about them washing their clothes?
Washing their clothes, it's the whole same thing. They don't have to wash their clothes. It was a waterless mikvah.
Okay.
No mikvah. They didn't have to wash their clothes. Okay, don't think of it on the natural. Think of it on the spiritual. Okay?
Okay.
They didn't have to wash their clothes because their clothes were already clean. Okay, your verse in 8:4 says this. But whenever it does this, this is the Torah's way of raising a red flag, saying, I've got something to show you. Look right here. And then you see this thing and you're going, wait a minute, this doesn't line up. This is not right. You can't wash your clothes if you have clothes that never wear out. Okay? And you would see the same thing with the verses. We'll probably talk about this next week, but you'll see the verses where it talks about eating. And it doesn't tell you what they ate. And so you're going, well, wait a minute, what did they eat? And so there's a couple of scholars out there, really heavy thinkers. I mean heavy thinkers, spiritual thinkers, that will tell you straight up, you know, these are the kind of things that you look for in the Torah. And when you look for them in the Torah, they're those red flags that are saying, hey, I've got a story to interest you. You probably are not really familiar with a guy named Rashi. If you look at the Torah Seder, we cite Rashi, his commentary on the Torah, and then the Targum, etc. But one of the things that's very interesting about Rashi, not a whole lot of people really, really understand Rashi and understand his writings, because they'll go into Rashi and they'll look for a verse and they'll want an explanation on it. Rashi doesn't say anything. And you go, man, of all the verses, that's the one I wanted to know, and he didn't write a thing. Well, Rashi had this idea. He was a grammatarian and, you know, a Torah scholar, absolute Torah scholar, French. But what he did was he didn't look for the verses that are self-explaining. So when you read it and it says something and it's literal and it's truth, he didn't even mess with it. What he would like to focus in on was those places where there is a problem in the text or something is not worded quite right and that it needs an explanation. But the interesting thing about what Rashi did was he made a whole bunch of rabbis jump on the same train. So when you start to read the rabbis, most of the time when you see the comments of the rabbis, they're because there's a problem there. And it needs to have some sort of solution. So I was reading this particular verse, and when I read the verse, I mean, for me, it was a red flag. Wait a minute, stay pure. How did they know the law's purity? Okay, it's because there was a spiritual Torah being used all along the way. And then keep their clothes. Well, we know that their clothes were not needing to be cleaned. Either that or the verse in 8 and 4 that you talked about, you cited, which is what I had. But either that verse was wrong or something's wrong in this passage. You see what I mean? So you have to look for the red flags. And that's just a red flag is what that is. That's what it is to me. And now there may be another explanation. And I wouldn't contend that because, like we said, 2 Jews, 3 synagogues, so... Very good question. Excellent question. Get ready, Bora.
I just want a clarification. When you first mentioned the Torah, that was a spiritual Torah that Abraham had, did you say Paduma or Kaduma?
Kaduma. Kaduma.
Kaduma.
Yeah.
Okay.
K-A-D-U-M-O-N-A-H. Or not okay. You, K-A-D-M-O-N-A-H, Kadmona.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. And one of the things that they say here is that the immersion has to be what they call a ruchaniyit, which means that it's a spiritual immersion. Okay, so they were asking, now listen to this. Now, you want the complexity of how it is. You think being baptized in the Holy Spirit comes from the New Testament? No. That's what this is right here. That's exactly what they're saying. Be baptized in the Spirit. And now, then you have to use another idea when it comes along with this, especially when you get to the part about eating and the fact that you see that they don't tell you what they ate. They call it a pneumatic revelation. Pneumatic means that the information is filled with spirit. Pneuma is spirit in Greek. Okay? So it says they have a pneumatic revelation. And literally, what they're trying to say, that this particular verse is impregnated with many spiritual possibilities. Okay? So this is how they talk. And, you know, I'll tell you the names, but I'm going to tell you something. You do not want to read this stuff until you are ready to read it, because it is very complicated. And when it starts talking about some things, you will go, oh my God, and you'll throw the book against the wall, and you will think, you know, that guy is, you will think more than he's crazy. And one of them is called Elliot Wolfson. He was a genius prodigy. He was an ultra-Orthodox boy who became a scholar, taught like in the Jerusalem yeshivas, not just yeshivas, but the university. And the other one is Joel Hecker. And Joel Hecker, I like Joel Hecker because he talks a lot about kissing. But it's what you've heard me talk about. You know, when you kiss, you share the breath back and forth. And that's from his basic idea. Now, he did not say that specifically, but that's his implication in a couple of his things. And now, if you're familiar with the modern, the very recent, most recent versions of the Zohar that have been translated, you will find that Daniel Matt has done like 8 versions, maybe 9, I don't know, maybe 10, I don't know. But then Joel Hecker comes in and he does the last 2 volumes, or at least 11 and 12, I know that he's done. So when you talk about that and you see that book and you see how complicated what they did was, you will be amazed. When you come to the house, I'll show you what one looks like on the inside. But there are older versions of it, but these versions are absolutely academic. And so those two people, Elliot Wolfson, he came out of the ultra-Orthodox community. And there's another guy that's like him. His name is Ellie Rubin. And Ellie Rubin, these guys are, now you wouldn't expect it, but in the ultra-Orthodox community, they are academics. But they're still, you know, practicing in the ultra-Orthodox community. Now, I think Elliot Wolfson, I have to be careful because I don't want to say that what he is or what he isn't. I think he's devoted more to just academia than, but he's still very, very pro-Jewish, pro-practice. In other words, one of the things they would have said about the clothes that they wore is that they're made out of the commandments, made out of spiritual material, etc., etc. So they're not just made out of just anything. So you're going to tell me you have to wash your clothes when your clothes are made out of the material that is in the other Torah. It doesn't fit. That's part of the reason why. Okay. And there's a couple other words that go with that, but we'll talk about that some other time. Gerrit Gibora.
I had one more question. When you were talking about Abraham and not having a Torah, because he knew the stars and the Torah was originally written in the heavens, because he was taught that, wasn't that where he got his Torah information from?
I think he had a lot more than that already. Because the reason I say that is because, you know, he was, you know, the tradition is that he was a drug before a Nimrod. And, of course, Nimrod was basically the king of the world at that point in time. Abraham was growing up, and of course the world at that point with Nimrod and all those, like Abraham's father, was all idolatry. All of Babylon was nothing but idolatry. But he said no, he had fundamentally a revelation of the one God. Some people say that he was the first preacher of monotheism. He was not. Okay, how do I know that? Am I just getting my piece of Torah out of the stars, or am I putting two pieces of the Torah together? Okay, Shem, where did Shem get his Torah? Right? So you understand that they both had the same ideas and the same Torah, and they could fellowship together. That's the whole idea. It existed in the spiritual world before it came to that. And you know the story also, that it was handed down from father to son. And Abraham is supposed to have gone to the yeshiva of Shem, where we have a connection that goes all the way back to Adam, of course. But that doesn't mean people that weren't spiritual giants like Abraham, with a super, super consciousness that could make him reach outside of the stars, you know what I mean? And go with God to this place that Gene Roddenberry only wished he could go. You know, you wonder if, you know, Gene Roddenberry had any influence over ideas like that. Why? Because it's not just Gene Roddenberry didn't just want to, and Abraham went outside. He literally went outside of our whole cosmos into the highest spiritual realms looking down. And basically Gene Roddenberry, you know, from his point of perspective in the day, he wanted to take a spaceship and go as far as he could. So he couldn't, so he used the next best thing, and that was his imagination. You can go anywhere in your imagination. Anywhere. You find a place in the Bible and it says this is a place, you can go there in your imagination. And now today you can probably Google it and get a curbside picture. Adon Shlomo.
I believe you said that when it says come and see, I was speaking of the spiritual realm.
Yes.
And the come in here is the physical realm.
Yeah, it's Talmud.
Yes. Well, I noticed that those are covered in the Exodus 19 passage.
Yes.
The people would only hear.
Yes.
When he spoke to
yes.
Moses.
Right.
So that they would believe and trust in Moses.
Right.
And on the third day, when God appeared on Sinai, in sight of all the people. I thought that was interesting.
Go to 20 and 18. And tell me what you see.
All the people saw the thunder and lightning. And the sound of the trumpet.
Okay.
So there they both saw it and heard it.
What did they see?
They saw the thunder and the flash of light.
Number one, you don't see thunder.
True. And the sound of the trumpet and the smoky mountain.
Okay. So then, of course, because we have there another red flag. Right? Mm-hmm. Because you don't see thunder, then you have to wonder what in the world is being said. When you go into the verse in Hebrew, just look it up, it'll say kol ot, voices.
Yes.
They saw the voices of God. Now, something is very peculiar there because you don't see voices, you hear voices. But this is a spiritual plane which is above even hearing. So here they're in a place that is beyond the normal. They're seeing the words of God. They're seeing the words come out of his mouth. Now, I told people years ago that I could not even imagine it. There's no way that you could see that. And up in Seattle, this gentleman came to our graduation and my ordination as Rabbi Clark Corwin. And he worked for Boeing like Adon Ezra. And when he came, and he heard me saying that one night on my thing, he sent me a little video, short snippet, and it had two poles on this little device, and the voice, the sound wave, was moving through the air, and you could literally see that impression in the air. Blew me away, because you were seeing the sound that was produced there. You know, you can watch the speakers move back and forth. This was literally a wave in the air that was doing this. Now, I wouldn't know how to interpret it that way, other than if I couldn't hear it. But nevertheless, that verse, the sages will get heavy on the commentaries on that particular verse right there, 18 and 20. They are 20 and 18. They will go crazy commenting on that verse, because they literally saw the words coming out of God's mouth. And this is one of the reasons why they make that distinction between hearing and seeing, is based on that verse. But you'll listen to Rabbi Akiva Tatz, and he will tell you basically the same thing. Seeing is spirituality, that is the higher level of spirituality, and hearing means, and he talks about it so well, because he talks about what happens when you hear. His Eminence, you could ask His Eminence, Rabbi Hillel, but he'll tell you, when you hear one word at a time, and then you have to assemble each word with the word that you heard, and then you have to either put it in a sentence, or as in the case of what we're doing right now, giving a lecture, then you have to go through the whole lecture to get that fine point at the very end. And so that's the whole point of hearing. You have to assemble all of the data in your mind as you're hearing it. But when you see it, I'm sure you know Watchman Nee, right? You know who Watchman Nee was? He's got a book called The Ministry of God's Word. And it's one of the book, you know, there's not a lot of data in that book that I really want a lot of guys to see. But one of the things he said is that when you receive revelation knowledge, it's like taking a picture with a camera. And when you take a picture with a camera, you can actually, you know, basically freeze time. And then you look at the picture and you see all the details of the picture. And he uses that analogy for revelation knowledge. It's called The Ministry of God's Word. It's very good. It's not a big book. You probably could buy it for a couple dollars on Amazon. But Rabbi Akiva Tatz will do that. But you will watch in, you know, the... if you read just a little bit of the Zohar, you'll find that it redundantly says come and see. But in the Talmud, it'll redundantly say come and hear. Come listen, whatever. Here, Gibora.
I was looking all over. I've been using my Chumash tonight. I was looking all over that verse the whole time you guys were talking. And it's totally different in the Jewish version. It's verse 15. It talks about the thunder and smoke and lightning. And then I looked up my regular Bible, and it's 2018. So I thought, man, I'm nuts. I can't see what they're saying.
Well, one of the things is, a lot of times it says that they perceived. It does not say mm-hmm. they saw. It says they perceived. Let me look in this book right here.
18 says, the people stood from afar, and Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. But in the English version, it's way down. It's like verse 19 says, you speak with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us lest we die.
Yeah, it's the same in this.
Quite different.
Yeah, it's the same in this. It's a different verse lineup.
Yeah, so it is interesting. I just thought it was, you know, if I can't find it, I have to look around it to see where it is. Because yeah. I know that sometimes the numbers are off.
Yeah. Yeah, in this is a Koran Bible. It's a Jewish Bible. It does the same thing. I think it's in verse 15. Any other questions or comments? Don Ezra, please, sir.
I was just going to say, in summation, we're not only told to wash in the Torah, as you stated all the time.
Yeah.
We're to eat the Torah.
Right. Right.
And we're to drink it. I mean,
absolutely.
Thirsty. Yeshua was saying he could give you water that, hey, you'll never crave another drink.
That's right. Absolutely.
As you pointed out, Krista was saying, well, I'm just going to be the dummy here. But no, these are, we read them over and over in the New Testament, the Old Testament, many other books, the equation of the Torah in those three forms. And we wash in it, we eat it, we drink it, we get married by it.
That's exactly right.
The Torah is joyful. And we just got to remember, don't limit ourselves, as you said, to just the written, because it can get pretty dry.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's why we enjoy your class so much, because it keeps our thirst going, keeps new neurons firing.
Well, one of the immersions that's fundamentally, you have, quote, those waterless immersions. You're talking about the very same thing. You're bathed in light. You're bathed in the Word, basically, all of those things. And, so when you start to imagine that, it's quite illuminating, I think.
It's quite freeing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Like you said, I love your analogy. You're sitting there parking your Countach Lamborghini, you're right there in traffic. And sometimes that's how it feels. And it's like I was so blessed today because I have a Cuban lady whose husband is in Honduras trying to get papers for up here also, and he's a preacher and all that. But anyway, so I had three or four women from Cuba, Mexico, talking Torah today. I felt like I was in that Lamborghini.
I
loved that. They were hungry,
Yeah.
They all know I'm a Jew there because I'm the only one out of 150 people that work there.
Yeah.
And they always ask questions.
Sure they do. Yeah.
What about Jesus? How does that fit in with...
Right. Of course.
It's easier to explain to Christians than it is to Jews. But anyway... I love the Lamborghini where we can get out and put the pedal to the metal.
Absolutely. God told me one time, I asked him for, I wanted a red Lamborghini Countach 5000, back in the day when that was the beast, And I prayed and asked God for this car, and he said, son, you can't afford the insurance. All right. Anybody else have anything to say?
Chag
Sameach. Shavuot, everybody. You guys have a wonderful Shavuot. We'll see some of you at the house. Shalom.
Shalom.